From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
She has this series of fantasy boyfriends. It kind of begins with Karl Marx and goes to Abraham Lincoln and Fiorello LaGuardia, and she ends up in a fantasy relationship with Archie Bunker.
Who brought the cat?
Wood, Margaret Atwood!
And we're now told that if you have a migraine headache, you should put a cat on your head. There are no instructions as to how to keep it there.
J.D. Salinger's first day of combat was D-Day. The quote that he told his daughter was that you never get the smell of burning flesh out of your nostrils, no matter how long you live.
Where does a great novel come from? What mysterious literary alchemy turns words and characters into a book for the ages? Today, stories of great novels and their authors. Canada's celebrated writer Margaret Atwood finishes a landmark piece of speculative fiction. We explore the secret life of America's most famous literary recluse, J.D. Salinger. And we'll try to get up close and personal with another writer who shuns the spotlight, Thomas Pynchon. But first, Jonathan Lethem. The New York Times once described him as a novelist who has spent a lifetime creating his own subversive pantheon. It's just been expanded to include Lethem's newest novel called Dissident Gardens. Jonathan Lethem talks with Steve Paulson about the book.
Jonathan, you've said that a lot of the writers you admire the most seem to be trying to be a different writer each time they write a new book, and that you would like to be that kind of writer. So I'm curious, has this novel, Dissident Gardens, taken you in a substantially new direction?
Yeah, I think it has in a whole bunch of different ways. First of all, you know, I find myself having difficulty even saying the words. It's a historical novel, right? And I'd never done that before, and I hadn't even really identified with it. But I never thought I liked reading historical novels. I like reading old fiction. I'd like reading about the 1950s by people who were alive and writing about it as it happened. But when I realized that I was setting out to do this, I was really at sea because I had to convince myself of something that as a reader I find very, very difficult to be convinced of, which is that the writer can have any meaningful authority over these periods that he's reconstructing in retrospect.
Well, I'm interested that you describe this as a historical novel, which obviously it is, as opposed to, say, a political novel, because it is so heavily immersed in the worlds of communism and of political activism.
Yeah, it's a depiction of characters who are defined by their commitment, their crazy passion for revolutionary change, for utopia. They want to live in a world other than the one that they've been given. And they do this in all sorts of mixed up ways in various parts of the 20th century and even on into the present, which for me actually was one of the keys to persuading myself of the project to begin with. I thought if I bring it to the present, I'll give evidence that I know what I feel is so true, that the story hasn't ended. It's not something sealed up in the past.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about what you think of the political novel, which has kind of been, I don't know if discredited is the right word, but it's fallen on hard times. I mean, there was a time back in the 1930s when some of the great writers out there, people like John Steinbeck and John Dispassos, wanted to write the political novel. I mean, they didn't want to just be literary. They wanted a call to action. They wanted their readers to go out and change the world. Does that history have any resonance for you?
Well, I think if the political novel is defined by that standard you just offered, I haven't come close to meeting it because this book would be a very, very hard banner to march under, you know, like, let us now go and what? What would we do?
Become disillusioned, maybe?
I don't really recognize a clear definition that I can cozy up to in the idea of the political novel. Instead, this is a book about political people. Honestly, if you want to know what I think politically, you might be better off going to some other things I've written. A novel called Chronic City, for me, is an emblem of all kinds of political outrage I felt that's sort of sublimated into this crazy story. This book isn't really like that. This is about the human experience of wanting the world to be other than it is. And in a way, it could almost have been done as readily from the right. I could have written this book about people who believed that McCarthy was right and then wanted Barry Goldwater to be president and then are in the Tea Party, because it was my insight that to be communist in the era that my characters were was actually a very American choice to make. It was very characteristic to be fitful and utopian and kind of place oneself at odds with history, that that was a characteristic way of participating in our history.
Now, I've heard that one of your characters, one of your main characters, Rose Zimmer, was to some degree modeled on your own grandmother. Is that right?
More than to some degree. I mean, I think I started the book thinking I'm going to take everything I know about my grandmother and put it into this character and then work from there and start from there. Now, of course, once you start summoning up all the things a child can know about a very complicated, very dark, very intense, charismatic, but also very silent and enigmatic older woman, turns out there's not much. So I had a lot to invent as well. I had to surround my suspicions and my projections about my grandmother with all sorts of information from other places and from other people's lives, frankly, and also with just my own crazy wishfulness, my fantasies about, for instance, the book is very much about this woman's sex life in some ways, even when it's not one that's being realized. She has a series of fantasy boyfriends. It kind of begins with Karl Marx and goes to Abraham Lincoln and Fiorello LaGuardia, and she ends up in a fantasy relationship with Archie Bunker.
I have to ask you about Archie Bunker from All in the Family. The premise here is so absurd. It's hilarious. Rose is this aging Jewish communist at this point, and Archie Bunker, of course, was the quintessential bigot, and she falls in love with him in her imaginary world.
Yeah. Well, she's got this perverse streak in her that's very confusing for her, I think, that she's into authority. She kind of likes the beat cop, and she likes the neighborhood priest, and she likes mayors and presidents. There's something about the command and the assurance that she's excited about, and she wants to retrieve this for her own purposes. It's a very personal feeling for her. And then at the end of her life, when most of the justifications that she held so close that had allowed her to maintain a kind of pure, hardline communist perspective have been stripped away from her. History has denied her any solace, you know, basically as it did to true believers throughout the 20th century. It was a series of shocks and humiliations. What's left to her is her relationship to the neighborhood. She's become, despite herself, a resident of Queens. And she begins to see this tapestry of kind of ethnic styles that Archie Bunker exemplifies as having its own power and authority. And so she's really into his charisma and his willfulness and his the way you identify with him without wanting to. You know, even though he's saying absurd things, you lean forward. And so she herself is thinking, if I could only have Archie for a minute, if I could only lure him into my bed, I would change him. I'd make him think right.
The ultimate leftist fantasy, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in fact, I'd love to get a taste of your story and of Rose. And maybe we can go back to the very beginning, the opening, when
sure.
It's sort of this classic moment of American communism here. Could you read that?
Okay, here goes. Quit screwing black cops or get booted from the Communist Party. There stood the ultimatum. The absurd sum total of the message conveyed to Rose Zimmer by the cabal gathered in her Sunnyside Gardens kitchen that evening, late fall 1955. Saul Eaglin, important communist, had rung her telephone. A committee wished to see her. No, they'd be happy, delighted, to come to her home. This evening, after their own conference just across the gardens, was 10 too late? This was a command, not a question. Yes, Saul knew how hard Rose labored, what her sleep was worth. He promised they wouldn't stay long. How did it happen? Easy. Routine, in fact. These things happened every day. You could get exiled from the cause for blowing your nose or blinking at suspicious intervals. Now, after so long, Rose's turn. She'd cracked the kitchen windows to hear their approach, brewed some coffee. Sounds of the gardens filtered in. Smokers, lovers, teenagers sulking in the communal lanes. Though winter's dark had clamped itself over the neighborhood hours ago, this early November night was uncannily balmy and inviting, last pulse of the earth's recollection of summer. Other kitchen windows were spilled to the lanes, voices mingled. Rose's plentiful enemies. Fewer friends. Others, so many others, simply tolerated. Yet, comrades all. According Rose their respect, even through their dislike. Respect to be robbed from her by the committee now entering her kitchen. There were five, including Eaglin. They'd overdressed, overcompensated with vests and jackets, now arraying themselves on her chairs like some Soviet oil painting, postured as if on some intellectual assignment. In pursuit of that chimera, the dialectical Hoosis, when really there was to be no dialectic here, only dictatorship and the taking of dictation. Still, Rose ought to be forgiving. These men were too young, apart from Eaglin, to have survived like she had the intellectual somersaults of the 30s, the onset of European fascism and of the Popular Front. They'd been children during the war. They were drones, men costumed in independent thought who'd become slaves of party groupspeak. None mattered in this room except the sole independent or thoughtful among them, a true and famous organizer, after all, a man of the factory floors, Saul Eaglin, and Rose Zimmer's former lover. Eaglin in his bow tie, hairline now gone behind his high cranium's arc like the winter's sun setting. Eaglin, the only among them man enough not to meet her eye, the only to grasp anything of the shame of it. Here was communist habit, communist ritual, the living room trial, the respectable lynch mob that availed themselves of your hospitality while dropping some grenade of party policy on your commitment, lifting a butter knife to slather a piece of toast and using it in passing to sever you from that to which you'd given your life. Yet that it was communist habit and ritual didn't mean these boys were good at it or comfortable. Rose was the veteran. She'd suffered one such trial 8 years ago. They sweated. She only felt exhaustion at their hemming and throat clearing.
Oh, that is so great. And you capture so much in just a couple of pages there.
Well, thanks.
And, you know, the true believers. And it's true believers who, well, I mean, you go back to that era in American history, and then you pick up the political scene with the hippies of the 60s and 70s, and you take it all the way up to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Why did you want to sort of trace that arc?
It connects, for one thing, to the first question you asked and my reply that the historical novel seems to me very hard to trust. You know, like, how can we really believe that the past is like this? Well, one way of testing it, or any way of being honest about this uncertainty that I felt, is to bring it right to the present so as to say, look, it connects, but also the past is a construction of the present. We have no way back there. We can only think about it on the terms of present experience and with present language, and it's probably being colonized at every corner by our current framework and our current thinking.
Jonathan Lethem is the author of The Fortress of Solitude, Chronic City, and his newest novel, Dissident Gardens. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And you can find the extended version of Steve's conversation with Lethem on our website, ttbook.org. Do you have a favorite novelist? Someone you think deserves greater recognition? Add to our crowdsourced list of great unsung novelists on Facebook or Twitter or on our website. Coming up, Margaret Atwood talks with us about her novel Mad Adam as we continue our Hour on Great Novelists. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Margaret Atwood is widely considered one of the best writers in English today. Her best-selling and critically acclaimed books, and those two don't always go together, include The Handmaid's Tale, The Robber Bride, and The Blind Assassin. For the last decade, Margaret Atwood's been working on a speculative fiction trilogy. The first book was called Oryx and Crake, and she's just published the final volume, called Mad Adam.
Rope. About the events of that evening, the events that set human malice loose in the world again, Toby later made two stories. The first story was the one she told out loud to the children of Crake. It had a happy outcome, or as happy as she could manage. The second, for herself alone, was not so cheerful. It was partly about her own idiocy, her failure to pay attention, but it was also about speed. Everything had happened so quickly. She'd been tired, of course. She must have been suffering from an adrenaline plunge. After all, she'd been going strong for 2 days, with a lot of stress and not much to eat. The day before, she and Wren had left the safety of the Mad Adam Cobb House enclave that sheltered the few survivors from the global pandemic that had wiped out humanity. They'd been tracking Wren's best friend, Amanda, and they'd found her just in time, because the two painballers who'd been using her had almost used her up. Toby was familiar with the ways of such men. She'd been almost killed by one of them before she'd become a God's gardener. Anyone who'd survived painball more than once had been reduced to the reptilian brain. Sex until you were worn to a fingernail was their mode. After that, you were dinner. They liked the kidneys. Toby and Wren had crouched in the shrubbery while the painballers argued over the raconte they were eating and whether to attack the Krakers and what to do next with Amanda. Wren had been scared silly. Toby hoped she wouldn't faint, but she couldn't worry about that because she was nerving herself to fire. Which to shoot first, the bearded one or the short hair? Would the other have time to grab their spray gun? Amanda wouldn't be able to help or even run. They had a rope around her neck with the other end tied to the leg of the bearded one. A wrong move by Toby and Amanda would be dead.
Very nice, thank you. Mad Adam is the final book in a trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake and Year of the Flood a few years later. I've seen that you've described this one as jauntier than the previous book, but I have to say, from listening to even those first few pages, doesn't sound particularly jaunty, does it?
Well, that was a reprise of the previous less jaunty events. It gets jauntier after that. That's only page 9.
But it does kind of sum up where things are at the beginning of the book. It helps us to understand it, and it moves us forward. It gets jauntier from there. Can you give us a kind of a storyline?
Well, it gets a bit jauntier. There are 3 time levels in the trilogy. One is before the waterless flood. The next is during the waterless flood, which is a pandemic virus that acts very rapidly and to which humanity has no immunity. And then the 3rd time period, which we're in now, is after that has happened. And I think after the worst is over, you always get a bit jauntier, don't you think?
You begin hoping for the future, I guess.
Yes, you're in a position from which you can plan forward at least a couple of weeks ahead, maybe.
One of the plans forward started much earlier, as a matter of fact, and we meet them right away at the beginning of this, the Krakers. We've met them before in the earlier volumes, but if you're picking up here, it's important to know who they are. They are genetically engineered humanoids?
They're genetically engineered humans, I maintain, who have had some of the defects removed from them that have bedeviled us over the millennia and have got us into a lot of scrapes. For instance, they have built-in sunblock, which would be a good thing, and they have built-in insect repellent, which I'm all for, and they have extra thick soles on their feet, and therefore they don't need the clothing industry, so they will never have any cotton plantations, nor will they be killing animals and wearing their skins. So they also have built-in purring, which they use to self-heal. And I did get some pushback on that from the first book when I put it in. But I note that science has now been working on that. And yes, cats purring apparently does have something to do with self-healing. And you will note that your cat will take quite an interest in you if you're ill, and it will get up and purr on the afflicted part. And we're now told that if you have a migraine headache, you should put a cat on your head. There are no instructions as to how to keep it there. So, you know, if somebody can invent that, the wear-to-work model of a cat on your head.
But I think most cat owners have had the experience of a cat wrapped around their head.
Absolutely. And you know that if somebody comes into the house and is afraid of cats, your cat will immediately go to that person because they want to help out. So they have self-healing purring, and better than everything, they will never suffer from romantic disappointment because they mate seasonally, unlike us. And to make things even clearer, so there will never be any confusion, parts of them turn blue at that time. And they do it in groups so that there isn't a paternity issue. And they will never have to have agriculture either because they can eat leaves and grass.
Mad Adam is, of course, the conclusion of a trilogy. It started with Oryx and Crake. Each of them has been described as dystopian. I guess the whole is called a dystopian trilogy, but I'm told that that's not the word you would use. Is that fair?
Well, these words get batted around quite a bit. So people use the word apocalypse to mean something bad has happened, but usually it means everything has been destroyed, which is not the case in these books. It's only human beings who have suffered a sad fate. Animals, plants, and fish are actually doing better, as they probably would. So dystopia usually means a very unpleasant society that we would not wish to live in. And that could be used about the first phase of time in the trilogy in which corporate rule is supreme and government has been reduced to a sock puppet. And people don't have anything outside the system to which they can turn for redress against the excesses of the system, which is why you don't want a monopoly and why you don't want government and business melding. So that part could be called a dystopia. The actual waterless flood could be called a cataclysm. And the part afterwards, I'm not sure what you would call it, because it's better for some, though obviously worse for all those who are no longer in a living condition.
I understand you use the word eustopia.
Well, that was when I was discussing the form. And what I said was that every literary utopia contains a little dystopia within it. And every literary dystopia contains a little utopia within it. So it's a yin-yang arrangement. They are as forms joined at the hip. They're twins. And you can't really write a utopia unless you understand that there's something worse. And you can't write a dystopia unless you understand that there's something better.
And that's, to some extent, where Mad Adam comes in. There is maybe something better in the middle of this?
Yeah, there's certainly something better, and there's certainly also something worse.
You sound to me like a fairly optimistic person. Would you think of yourself that way?
Well, I'm just a little bundle of sunshine in my daily life. Why not? Every writer is inherently optimistic, no matter how pessimistic the content they may produce, because writing is in itself an optimistic act. Just think about it. You're assuming a future reader, which is a big leap. Every time you write something down, you're assuming that somebody's going to read it at the other end. So you're also assuming the possibility of human communication. And you're assuming that that's a good thing. So when you're writing a book, you're assuming that you're going to finish it, not always justified by the facts. You're assuming that somebody's then going to publish it, also not so easy. Then you're assuming that people will read it. Wow, what a jump. And then that they will like and understand it, which is a pretty big bunch of optimism. And that is why Jimmy and Oryx and Craig does not keep a Robinson Crusoe-like journal of his experiences, because he cannot imagine a future reader. He thinks he's the last person on earth who can read. Whereas Toby does, because she can imagine future readers, and she even goes so far as to go about creating them.
Margaret Atwood is the author of Mad Adam. It's the final volume in a trilogy that began with Oryx and Crake. her 14th novel. You can find a link to my extended conversation with Margaret on our website at ttbook.org. You can also get in touch with us there. You'll find links to our Facebook and Twitter accounts. Coming up, we look at the lives and work of two of the most celebrated and reclusive writers of our time, Thomas Pynchon and J.D. Salinger, as we conclude our Hour on Great Novelists. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thomas Pynchon is one of the most famous novelists in the world. Whole college courses are taught about his books Gravity's Rainbow, V, and The Crying of Lot 49. You'd think, in this age of social networks and increasing digital transparency, you'd think we'd know what Thomas Pynchon looks like, wouldn't you? We don't. You can find his 1953 high school yearbook picture online, and a few others. Of course, there's no photo on the dust jacket of Pynchon's new novel, Bleeding Edge, either. But a speculative rendering of Pynchon, who is now 76, accompanies Boris Kachka's story On the Thomas Pynchon Trail, published online at vulture.com. Kachka talks with Steve Paulson about the life and work of this famously reclusive writer.
Boris, is the publication of a new Thomas Pynchon novel still a literary event?
Not as much as it was when he hadn't written a novel for 17 years and Vineland came out. Probably not as much as when Mason Dixon came out and it was his first and most coherent historical novel and people were wondering what he was going to do with it. I still think it is, though. I think that there is enough of a fan base and really there's no voice like his that people always want to know. Certain people always want to know what he's up to.
When you say there's no voice like his, what do you mean? What makes Thomas Pynchon special, unique?
I think anytime you have a unique voice and you really try to break it down, it tends to come down to a unity of contradictions. And I think with him, you've got the sacred and the profane. To do my story, I had to go back and reread Gravity's Rainbow, and I was astonished and embarrassed to be reading scenes in public of orgies. And then right after that, you have a profound meditation on the political forces that shape our lives. You're not going to get that from one book or from one author in too many places. And he's just hands down, sentence by sentence, a wonderful writer, too.
Well, let's talk some about his brand new novel, which is called Bleeding Edge, which you have described as a grizzled wanderer's wary truce with New York conformity and life in public. What do you mean?
I hope that doesn't sound reductive because I was approaching it from a biographical perspective. There are a lot of ways that you can read this new book if you choose to read it. But one of them, I think, is that he's writing about a very recent past in a place where he currently lives. This is someone who, for many, many years, for decades, made a point of not letting anyone know where he lived, including his agent at times. And now he's making these pop references. He's writing about, in some cases, the building where he lived. If you know the city at all, you can pretty much pinpoint almost the apartment that he lived in 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, he lives on New York's Upper West Side now, right?
Yes, he does. Mm-hmm. But he's switched around a little bit. But more importantly than these physical locations, I think, is that especially in these scenes where you have a sort of idea of escape or refuge and also the idea of being safe and home and keeping the children safe, I think it doesn't take too much of a leap to knowing that he has a child, that he sends his child to the best schools, but that he also has this very anarchic sensibility and that he has lived out that anarchism for decades before settling down in New York. I don't think it takes much to read into it his own struggles and contradictions and trying to make an accommodation with a life and a family, having wandered for so long.
Well, can you give us a brief outline of the storyline of Bleeding Edge?
I think that's the hardest question you're going to ask me. Essentially, I think I have to reread it, but Maxine Tarnow, who's a fraud detective on the Upper West Side, she somehow catches on to an investigation of this company called Hashslingers. This is right after the Silicon Alley 1.0 bust that hit New York and several months before 9/11. And she catches on to this villainous guy, Gabriel Ice, a sort of Jeff Bezos on crack. And there's something going on where he's manipulating hackers and buying up all this broadband. And he has some kind of plan to funnel money between different countries. Before and after September 11th occurs, it may somehow be tied in with that. There's a sort of play with red herrings and conspiracy theories. In the long run, I think it's about a time and a place right before 9/11, and it's also about paranoia and the idea that basically other people whose motives you don't understand want to control you. And that, I think, is true of this book and of Gravity's Rainbow and of V and of every single one of his books.
So this book is dealing with two historical events, really. One is 9/11, and the other is kind of the earlier days of the internet. And it would seem that both of these subjects play very well into what we think about as Thomas Pynchon's passions. I mean, paranoia, you've already mentioned, conspiracy, stuff happening underneath the surface. He's created the perfect tableau to deal with the subjects he loves.
Yes, and it's also a time of confusion. And I think the state of a Pynchon novel is always a state of confusion because although he plays with conspiracy theories, he never provides any answers. And I think for all the knowledge that is poured into his books, that's the emotional heart of his books, is the feeling that other people know more than you do and they control your actions and manipulate you. And that's why most of his books are sort of thrillers in a way. This is a guy who was playing with circuit boards in the early 70s, late 60s, and has always been fascinated by computers. If you go back to Crying of Lot 49 in 1966, he was comparing a city's layout to a circuit board, and he's always been fascinated by both the freedom and the capacity for surveillance and control that the coming digital revolution was offering.
Well, it's funny to talk about these things now, and given the recent revelations from Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks and all of that. Pynchon is right there with us, with the current news.
Yeah, I wonder whether he made any last-minute changes. It's hard to say. But there is a prescience there that you can't deny.
In the novel, he talks about something called the deep web. Can you explain what that is?
The deep web is the ungooglable internet, essentially. Hard for me to say whether it exists anymore. Maybe you'd have to ask him. But it certainly did back then. And I think what it was, and there was another part of it called Deep Archer, Departure, but also Deep Archer, that was basically like a SimCity type game. Both of these places were refuges from Google, from the corporate world, and very much the most lyrical sections of the book are set there.
So the idea is that there is this whole layer of the web that is beyond what ordinary people can get at. No search engine, Google or anything else can get you there, but some people have access to it.
Well, it's an interesting way of thinking about it because I think in the book it's framed as a place of freedom, but freedom for those who know about it, who are clued into it. Again, I hate to keep referring back to other books, but Tristero, whether it exists or not in the world of Crying of Lot 49, is very similar. It's an alternative to the U.S. postal system that's run by sort of homeless couriers. So that's a secret world of escape and freedom from the corporate forces around you. And I think that's how he saw Deep Web.
Originally, the guys, you have to wonder how presciently, had it in mind to create a virtual sanctuary to escape to from the many varieties of real-world discomfort. A grand-scale motel for the afflicted, a destination reachable by virtual midnight express from any place with a keyboard. Creative differences arose, to be sure, but went strangely unacknowledged. Justin wanted to go back in time to a California that had never existed. Safe, sunny all the time, where, in fact, the sun never set, unless somebody wanted to see a romantic sunset. Lucas was searching for someplace, you could say, a little darker, where it rains a lot and great silences sweep like wind, holding inside them forces of destruction. What came out as synthesis was Deep Archer. Whoa, Cinerama here. Cute, huh? Verva, switching on a gigantic 17-inch LCD monitor. Brand new, retails for about $1,000, but we got price. You're assimilating. Maxine, meantime, reminding herself that she has never had a clear idea of how these guys make their money.
Of course, Thomas Pynchon is not the only reclusive writer in the news these days. I mean, the late J.D. Salinger was, you know, famous, of course, for his privacy, and well, Salinger, I mean, he was always described as a recluse. Is Pynchon a recluse, as far as we know?
Well, he has been both self-mocking about it. In The Simpsons, there's a portrayal of him with a paper bag over his head.
Here's your quote. Thomas Pynchon loved this book almost as much as he loves cameras. Hey, over here. Have your picture taken with a reclusive author. Today only, we'll throw in a free autograph. But wait, there's more.
Do we know why Thomas Pynchon is so obsessed with privacy? I mean, to the point where there is no acknowledged photograph of him since when? Since he was a teenager?
It's a big, big question. And is it political or is it psychological? Is it the belief that the writer's words should stand for themselves? I think he believes that. I think he also believes that being outside the grid is important. I think that he is deeply psychologically afraid of having his picture taken, which probably has something to do with his teeth. I think there's a sort of WASP reserve that somehow comes into it, which is actually something he probably has in common with his family, even though for so many years he was sort of running away from his family and his background. It's all of those things. It may be related to some trauma he had as a child, which I heard a little bit about. Maybe I'm being overly psychological here, but I think there must be something psychological at the heart of it.
What's your sense of how people will think about Thomas Pynchon in future years, 20 years from now, 50 years from now? Will he be remembered?
It's really difficult to say when you're close to it, when he's still around. But the stuff I said about the contradictions of his writing, I think there are things that he's done that are unique to him, and he's a unique and outstanding voice. And I think that that is the surest way to immortality. So I wouldn't be surprised if he outlasts Salinger.
Boris Kachka is the author of On the Thomas Pynchon Trail, a story published on Vulture.com. We've linked to it on our website, ttbook.org. Kachka is also the author of Hot House, The Art of Survival and the Survival of Art, at America's most celebrated publishing house, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And now, another famous literary recluse.
Catcher in the Rye caught my attention when it first came out.
There had not been a voice like that.
Nobody sells 60 million copies of a book and disappears, but J.D. Salinger did.
He turned his back on celebrity before celebrity was celebrity.
Became the Howard Hughes of his day.
J.D. Salinger, the author of the classic novel The Catcher in the Rye, kept a famously low profile in life, and even after death. Now, Shane Salerno has uncovered a few of his secrets in a documentary and a companion book called Salinger. And Strange Champs talks with him.
So Salinger has been written about before, and there have been biographies. There have been people who knew him, have editors, former lovers, children have written articles and memoirs. What do you think are the most important things that you've added to his story or changed?
The difference between our book and those books were largely that in some of those cases, several of those cases, particularly recent cases, they wrote a whole book without ever speaking to one person who actually knew J.D. Salinger. They were sort of companion books or sort of compilation books of what was in the public record. I think what we did that was very different is we spent years and years convincing people to tell their stories for the first time. And we interviewed people who had held on to their stories entirely, whose name didn't even appear in the public record associated with Salinger for 60 years. So you have someone like Jean Miller, who met Salinger when she was 14 years old in 1949 and really dated him between the ages of 14 and 19. It wasn't sexual until she was of age, but they had a romantic relationship from 14 to 19.
And he was how old?
He was 30 when he met her. And 35 when they split up. Jean, who's a wonderful lady, she originally had over 100 letters from Salinger, but she had kept about 50 of the letters and had never shown them to anyone. He had this extraordinary relationship with this young girl, and it was interesting time, 49 to 54, because it was prior to the publication of The Catcher in the Rye and after it, prior to moving to Cornish, New Hampshire, and after it. And so you get this incredible vantage point of this soldier back from World War II with post-traumatic stress syndrome trying to connect with this 14-year-old girl.
You say you still feel 14. I know the feeling. I'm 34, and too much of the time I still feel like a 16-year-old Holden Caulfield.
And she becomes the inspiration for Esme, and he ends up telling her that he could have never written Esme without her.
Esme for Love and Squalor, one of the famous short stories. One of the things that you discovered that you write about a lot is how important Salinger's experiences in World War II were to him. You came to see it as really central to his writing and much of the rest of his life. What exactly did he do in World War II?
Well, I mean, let's just start with what he saw. This was a kid who grew up at 1133 Park Avenue. He had never suffered a day in his life. He was a privileged, very wealthy kid. He went to war thinking that it was going to be this romantic experience, like a Jack London novel. And what he found instead was really the worst horrors of World War II. J.D. Salinger's first day of combat was D-Day. He ended up participating in one form or another in D-Day, the Battle of San Lo, the Battle of the Hurricane Forest, Battle of the Bulge.
Did he actually see much action?
Yes. At different times he did see action. At different times he was under fire. He was a counterintelligence agent, not an infantryman. So he wasn't on the front lines every day, but he definitely saw combat. He definitely was under fire.
He was also one of the first Americans to see some of the German concentration camps, am I right?
Yes, he walked in among the first soldiers to walk into a subcamp of Dachau called Kaufering. And in the film, in the book, we show for the first time ever what he actually saw. And that experience was so traumatic. The quote that he told his daughter and also Gene Miller and others was that you never get the smell of burning flesh out of your nostrils, no matter how long you live. And that was so traumatic that he checked himself into a mental institution immediately after the war.
How long did he stay?
He stayed for about 6 months. And what's amazing is, in the middle of all of this, he was writing and publishing throughout the war in Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. And that was kind of an incredible thing to see. Not that just somebody who was jotting down some things in a journal, but he was actually writing and seeing his stories published. And there's a very famous story we have in the film, in the book, in 1944, after the liberation of Paris, Salinger wanting to meet Ernest Hemingway, who was staying at the Ritz and assigned to Salinger's 4th Division, and Salinger pushing through a crowd to get to Hemingway and hand him his Collier story. And they become close friends. Salinger, if you can believe this, J.D. Salinger and Ernest Hemingway.
And didn't you say that Salinger actually went to battle with some of the chapters of The Catcher in the Rye with him?
They never left his side. I mean, when he landed on D-Day, he landed with the first 6 chapters of The Catcher in the Rye. And we know that from a letter that he wrote to Whit Burnett, his teacher at Columbia. Those pages saw all of the battles that I named and walked into that concentration camp at the end of the war.
So what's interesting is that for all that his war experiences really marked him, we don't think of him as a war writer. I mean, I can't remember in any of the stories or in Catcher in the Rye, I don't think any of them are set in battlefields or wartime experiences.
Well, they're set with wartime experiences, but they're not set on the battlefield. He only really wrote of actual combat one time, which was in an unpublished story called The Magic Foxhole that we excerpt in the book. World War II is really the ghost in the machine of all those stories. They are the answers to issues in Perfect Day for Banana Fish and Esme, and certainly the 9 stories, which begin and end with echoes of World War II.
Wait, what do you mean? Why do you think the war is the ghost in the machine in a lot of his writing?
The characters are soldiers in several of the key stories. Some of those soldiers have the same dog tag numbers that Salinger had. The issues of depression and suicide that permeate some of those stories are rooted in the fact that J.D. Salinger was suffering from depression and post-traumatic stress syndrome. In The Catcher in the Rye, he talks very much about the war and says if there's another war, he wants to get on the bomb and ride it all the way down himself, climb on top of it and ride it all the way down himself, which, of course, Stanley Kubrick took quite literally for Dr. Strangelove. If it wasn't for World War II, we would have never heard the name J.D. Salinger. I mean, before World War II, J.D. Salinger was a serviceable short story writer. In fact, he never allowed those early pre-war stories to ever be published in book form because he called them the gaucheries of his youth. It's only after the war, after the mental institution, after all of the horrors that he saw, that he becomes J.D. Salinger and has that extraordinary voice. And that's when we get Banana Fish and Esme and Catcher and the 9 stories.
Well, in the first place, he said it was a perfect crime the Army released him, Seymour, from the hospital. My word of honor. He very definitely told your father there's a chance, a very great chance, he said, that Seymour may completely lose control of himself. My word of honor.
There's another weird story that comes out of his time during World War II. It's the story of his first wife. This was a woman he met during the war, and you suggest that she might have been a Gestapo informant?
After the mental institution, J.D. Salinger did something that no one else would really do. I mean, after everything that he had seen and having checked himself into a mental institution, most people would have gone home. And what he did, and when I found this out, this is when I really said I have to make this film. What Salinger did that was so unique is he signed back up for more. He signed up a post-war contract to be part of the denazification of Germany. And in the process of really trying to hunt the people down that did these horrible things, he met and married a German woman named Sylvia Welter and brought her home legally to his parents' Jewish Park Avenue apartment with a big German dog and tried to integrate the two worlds that he had seen, the world that existed before the war and the world that existed for him now.
That marriage lasted, what, a year? Less?
It was a very short marriage, and in the process of spending time with her in New York, he found out that she had actually been an agent for the Gestapo, and we interviewed several people who confirmed this on the record, including Leela Hadley, a very close friend of his, and someone who actually dated him. And, you know, immediately upon finding this out, he filed for an annulment and really sent her back to Germany. The public record for 50 years has been that they filed for divorce and she went back, but it's not true at all. We actually recovered and found and published the annulment papers, which we found in Germany, in German, and had to translate. And he would not have anything to do with her ever again. And in fact, around his house called her Saliva instead of Sylvia.
We should talk about Salinger's notorious penchant for privacy. He's often considered, you know, one of the most famous literary recluses in history. He publishes Catcher in the Rye, becomes an almost overnight celebrity, and everybody in America knows who he is. And then at the height of all of this, he disappears.
One of the myths we dispel in the film and the book is that he was a recluse. He was not a recluse, and there was nothing reclusive about J.D. Salinger. What he was extraordinarily private.
What's the difference?
Well, there's a very big difference. Think of Howard Hughes, who was a true recluse. Howard Hughes would never do any of the things that J.D. Salinger did. I mean, J.D. Salinger traveled the world. J.D. Salinger had many affairs. He had lifelong friendships. He would go to everything from the church dinner every Sunday in his community, and he would see actresses on TV and fall in love with them and write them letters and go see them. Can you imagine Howard Hughes showing up at a Peter DeVries play and not only watching the play, but going backstage and introducing himself to the cast?
So why does everybody think Salinger was a recluse?
There's just a myth that has endured for decades that he was a recluse. The fact is he would go into New York City almost every week and have lunches. He would hang out with friends. There's just nothing reclusive about J.D. Salinger. But if you look up the word recluse, J.D. Salinger's name is the first thing that pops up. It's an extraordinary thing. Listen, he was very good at being a recluse who, whenever the world forgot about him for a minute, popped out to remind the world that he was a recluse.
Shane Salerno produced and directed the documentary Salinger and co-authored the companion book with David Shields. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Salerno tells us that new fiction by J.D. Salinger will be released between 2015 and 2020. We did a show on handwriting recently, and listeners sent in dozens of examples of their own, from grandma's recipes and long-lost love letters to personal journals, even an address book. Ironically, most of the submissions came via email. One day, though, a postcard mysteriously arrived, hand-colored in blue and black ink. The handwriting looked like Cyrillic.
Marina Tsvetaeva, Pismo. Так писем не ждут. Так ждут письма. Тряпичный лоскут, вокруг тесьма из клея. Внутри словцо и счастье. И это все.
We were excited. The only problem, our Russian translation skills weren't really up to the job. Then a few days later, another postcard arrived, printed in the same blue and black design, and this time the handwriting was in English.
Marina Tsvetaeva. A letter. So they don't expect letters. So they wait for a letter. A ragged scrap, circled by sticky tape. Inside, a scribble. And happiness. And that's all.
So now we were intrigued. No name, no return address. But they kept coming, first in Russian, then in English, with drawings that matched the poems. And they were beautiful. One was a pen and ink drawing of a barge floating down the Oka River. Another, a man threshing in a field. Again, hand-painted, the autumn colors vibrant. We started waiting by the mailbox.
Осень в Тарусе. Ясное утро, не жарко. Лугом бежишь налегке. Медленно тянется барка вниз по оке.
Autumn in Tarusa. A clear morning. The air is cool. Lightly you cross the meadow. On the Oka, a barge slowly draws by.
The postcards blew us away. We passed them around. We told stories about them. We panicked when one went missing. When we found it, I thought, why did we care? Why did this unknown person send these to us? Was there a message for us? And would there be more?
Несколько слов по неволе все повторяешь подряд. Где-то бубенчики в поле слабо звенят. В поле звенят? На лугу ли? Едут ли на молодьбу?
Unwilled, a word is speaking itself over and over, and others follow. A bell can be heard somewhere, faintly rung in a field. Are they going to be threshing? Autumn in Tarusa. Marina Tsvetaeva.
Curious about these postcards from our anonymous correspondent? You can see them, front and back, in English and Cyrillic, on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Great Novelists. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Special thanks to our postcard readers, Victoria Gorbich and Norman Gilliland, and to special guest engineer Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.